This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When Kate Bowler was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer last year, one of her first thoughts was, well, isn't this ironic? She had just written a book called Blessed. Kate is a scholar in the prosperity gospel. It's a theology that if people follow specific rules, God will reward, heal, and restore. Kate grew up in a predominantly Mennonite community in Manitoba, Canada, and spent much of her childhood and teen years in Mennonite youth camps and a Bible camp as well. Her faith evolved as she grew up, and she began to identify as evangelical, though she is quick to point out that Canadian evangelicalism looks a lot different than it does here in the United States. Kate got a master's in divinity at Yale and a PhD at Duke. She's currently a professor of history of Christianity in North America at Duke Divinity School, where she's working on a project right now on women and power in the American mega ministry. And now, as she comes to terms with her diagnosis, her studies have taken on even deeper meaning. Kate Bowler, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
So glad to be here.
Take us back a little bit. What was going on in the past few months? Tell us about your diagnosis.
Sure. I just had some weird stomach pain, and I have a pretty high pain tolerance, and so I just did the suck it up plan for a while, and then it was the endless doctor's plan. I was sent home from the ER at one point with antacids and a somewhat sardonic expression on my face, and then eventually I just said, that's it. Like, you're gonna have to treat me, comma, people. And so I went to a doctor and said, look, you can't send me back out there. You've got to do more scans. And then, so we did some scans, and then the next day I got a call in my office that said I had stage 4 cancer, which was bananas to me because I have no cancer in my family, and there was really kind of no sense that this was coming, so it was a real surprise.
How old are you?
35.
What did you do right then and there?
I think I did all the things you think you might do in the circumstance. I fell to the ground and cried, and then I called my husband, who lives nearby, and he came, and I said, you just feel like you have to say all the things that you need to say, like, I have loved you forever, and please take care of our son, and what are we going to do? And then he walked me to the hospital, and we checked in, and I remember feeling like the world was on the other side of plexiglass. Like, all of a sudden my life was totally different and I had no idea what was going to happen.
What kind of prognosis were they giving you?
Well, at first it was really grim. They said, and it was hard because they sent the person with the shortest lab coat in to tell me, which always means that they're the lowest on the totem pole. I think maybe they picked him too because he's from Canada. They thought maybe that would bring me comfort. So he sat there and he told me that I would have a 30 to 50% chance of making it past 5 years, which is their survival, how they count survival. And I just remember saying, if you're going to tell me news like that, you better hold my hand. Yeah. So I forced everyone to hold my hand. But it was one of those things where you really don't know if the numbers apply to you because they're not typically made for 35-year-olds. As it turns out, I have a rare form of cancer where it's a mismatch repair disorder where your body tries to fix itself. It makes errors and then it sends an enzyme to fix itself, and I lack that enzyme. And so an error would duplicate another error and an error. So that's why it grew tumors.
And it really complicates the treatment regime as well.
Yeah, it did. I mean, it also opened up new possibilities, which was great. But for the first bit, it was just me going to Duke and then like a physician's assistant saying something like, well, the sooner you get used to the idea that you're going to die, the better. And that was kind of where we were at for the first few months.
Talking about palliative care right away. So,
he really just, yeah, they really started with the word palliative. And your mind just boggles because it makes all these plans. Even when you think you're not making plans, you've guaranteed your own future in your mind, and then all of a sudden you have to revisit all of that.
Well, you do. I mean, it would surprise all of us, I suppose, to see how far out we've planned and how detailed those plans are and how sure we are about those plans, and you probably don't know that until somebody tells you.
And some you feel entitled to, and then others are just a given, like, I'm going to be a parent. I'm going to have all those awkward talks with that kid. I'm going to endlessly persecute his girlfriends. I mean, you make these plans and you're so sure they're going to happen.
You said it did open up other treatment possibilities. Tell us about that and what's happening now.
Well, because it's a very odd kind of cancer, it makes me a delightful candidate for new clinical trials. So I'm somewhat of a unicorn in the cancer world. So it means that they're starting a number of studies for this one particular drug for that targets the immune system. It's kind of, they think of as a renaissance in cancer studies in which you might be able to use the body's own system to target cancer. So because I have this odd form, then I was eligible for a trial at Emory. So I fly out once a week, get up at 4 a.m. and I'm back at midnight, and I get a drug that for 100 milliliters costs $16,000, and I'm grateful for it.
You do that, but then because it's a trial, they're checking on you pretty regularly, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty grueling regimen because they give you the regular standard of care, which is one bajillion, technical term, chemo drugs, and then plus the immuno. So I'm about 5 months into treatment, almost 6 months into this new reality, and I'm starting to get a little tired.
Part of that new reality is not only the fatigue, the travel, but the fact is what they're checking for is to see if it's working.
Yeah, it creates a really intense timeline. So every 60 days, I find out if it's working, and if it's working, I get another 60 days of treatment. And if it doesn't work, then I don't have a lot of other options so far. So far, my tumors are inoperable. So it means I sort of get a 60-day lease on life at a time. I kind of picture it like I walk to the edge of the cliff, and I hope that by the time I get there, God and science has built a bridge, and then I can cross over and I get a new 60 days. You can imagine it makes me have to live very consciously in the present.
I want to talk more about that, but I want to talk about this initial reaction that you had. Speaking of God and science, your work focused on the prosperity gospel, hence the sense of irony when you got your diagnosis. Tell us more about that.
Well, I wanted to be the first person to make the hashtag blessed joke because it was so ridiculous. I mean, I have been an expert in spiritual certainty for 10 years, and it's the only thing I'm an expert in. And so to have spent so many years interviewing people in hospital beds and at healing rallies and in wheelchairs about how they map the distance between the reality they're living in and the certainty that they have that God will heal them in the here and now if they have the right kind of faith. It was so disorienting then to have this flood of the same responses from people that I knew. Well, just pray in a certain way. Have you tried this? I mean, everyone has their answer for you, in part because they're frantic and they love you, and in part because that's the only explanation they have.
But to be clear, your interest in prosperity gospel was academic. It wasn't part of your actual faith experience.
Sure. Yeah, no. I mean, I come from a Mennonite tradition in which they love to despise things that are shiny. I mean, they were the first to paint chrome off their bumpers when they got their first cars. And they would debate everything from lace curtains to Linda, who has a nicer dress on Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. So they were always, they marked the difference between themselves by their hatred of the material, really. And so so then to go on and be an expert in a gospel of endless abundance was a real departure for me.
But you also noted the reaction, you were talking about some of the reaction of friends once they found out. Everybody has a certain need for certainty. So in the academic world, it took one kind of valence, one sort of point of view, and in the religious world, another. But everybody wants to be certain somehow.
Oh, everybody wanted to pour certainty on my problem. Mm. There was the health nuts who were desperate to find me the right kind of kale as opposed to the wrong. There will always be a wrong kind of kale, apparently. There were the academics who were, and I love them, in part the worst because they're information junkies. So all they wanted to do was Google every part of my life history, which of course is useless to me now because, you know, thank you for your book on early detection, but we're a little late for early detection. So, and then there's just all the kind of cultural little sing-songy things we say to each other, that God is always closing doors and opening windows, which I just, a friend of mine had bone cancer as a teenager, and had to have his legs cut off. And he is a model and an inspiration to me of dignity and the way that he handles everyone's reaction. But I loved when he called me and he was like, Kate, how am I supposed to get in through all these windows without legs? I mean, what kind of God is this?
This shines a light, I think, on the real complexity and paradox in all of this. And we're going to talk more about this as we go on. But the idea that there's really nothing wrong with those bromides to a certain extent, it's when they're used as a way of creating certainty rather than embracing the uncertainty of it, that yes. They become
formulas.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we all have, I mean, whether we like it or not, we have formulas for how we think we're going to get from here to the end. Is we all make up stories about how, you know, for me, honestly, I thought my sparkling personality and my endless attention to detail, I mean, I had all these stories about why I was special and how maybe nothing so terrible would happen to me, because surely I have all these things to offer. And then all of a sudden, when things come crashing down, you realize I mean, theologically speaking, I have to be about as special as everybody else. And that's hard.
We will find out just how special as our conversation continues with Duke Divinity Professor Kate Bowler, the author of Blessed, A History of the American Prosperity Gospel, and a recent New York Times piece, Death, the Prosperity Gospel, and Me. And we're going to continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I invite you to stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. With me this hour is Kate Bowler. She's a scholar of Christianity in North America at Duke Divinity School and the author of Blessed, A History of the American Prosperity Gospel. So we're talking about your diagnosis and how you're coming to terms with it and your scholarship. I want you to take us back now to your earlier days growing up in Manitoba. You mentioned living among Mennonites. Your family wasn't a Mennonite family.
No, we just went to a mostly Mennonite church, and then I was forever indoctrinated in Mennonite Bible camps in the ways of simplicity, pacifism, and general agriculturalism. I am from the worst part of Canada, for sure. I mean, it is.
You know, it's all, forgive me, but it's all looking good to me now.
Yes.
Better and better.
In this election season.
Surely Canada, but go ahead.
Yes, we will welcome you all with open arms. I will say that officially. Yeah, it is,
but
surely.
But it's the prairie. That's kind of just north of Minnesota.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's minus 40 in the winter, and it has the greatest people on earth. Yeah. In the worst possible place. It has the unfortunate distinction, if you look at Mennonite diaries when they first settled in the 1860s, where they're like, oh no, it is both swampy and frozen here in this land. And it hasn't changed much since.
They had deep voices, apparently.
They had very deep voices, yes.
So you got there. Why were you there?
My parents did their PhDs in London. That's where I was born. And then that's where my mom got a job. Both my parents are academics. My mom's a music professor. So I spent a ridiculous amount of time in green rooms in foreign countries watching Ghost be dubbed over in German and then again in Czech in a single low voice. And my dad's, unsurprisingly, a history professor. So I'm just a giant stereotype.
What about your religion? I mean, what did they teach you about religion?
They were a lovely combination of endless piety. This is my mom, in which she is the most sincere person on the planet. So, of course, she's perfect to torture. Mm. And she was in college, and she got one of those four spiritual laws pamphlets, if you've ever seen them, where you get this sort of like threefold thing, and it'll say, did you know you're a sinner? And, of course, my mom was like, oh, well, I guess maybe I am. And, you know, do you want repentance, et cetera, et cetera. And then by the end of the pamphlet, she was totally convinced and has made a lovely, lovely Christian ever since. And my dad read Augustine and he thought, sure, this is a worldview I'm all on board with. And somehow the combination of the two is me.
You lived, as you say, the Mennonite philosophy is simplicity. And you didn't have a lot of money growing up either. Your parents didn't.
No, we had a lot of terrible vacations in the back of a Datsun, an unair-conditioned Datsun, driving to Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, where they're always very defensive about what a lovely spa they have. Which means it's a terrible place. When people tell you the one feature, you know it's a terrible place.
Hotels that boast color TV. You know.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And plastic sheets. It was, not a lot of money. This was in part because my mom had the good job and my dad was adjunct. And so he taught at every single podunk and established college this side of, I don't know, the Red River.
But how did growing up in those Mennonite Bible schools and in that environment, I mean, did that help you sort of tolerate all of that? I mean, not having much is a virtue in those communities, I guess.
Yeah.
Or is it?
It is, though they are plainclothes capitalists for the most part. I mean, like, you should see their farms. They are bonkers fancy. But it really did. They try to strip down the gospel to its basics, and they're wonderfully community oriented. So they're a tribe. And after a while, I realized, like, they're a tribe I sort of want to belong to, though they are an abomination with Jell-O salads. I've seen them put deli meat in there, and that really happened.
I don't want to think about that for another. You went to a French deli meat in the Jell-O?
Yeah, really? No. And honestly, it was on a buffet table outside, one of those picnic things, and I stood there and I yelled as a 14-year-old, "Who did this? Take responsibility."
Is it a way to disguise? Yeah. Like, it looks simple, but really there's some really spicy salami in there?
Yeah, yeah, no, it's a mold.
Let me talk about your school. French immersion school and then a Catholic. You got kicked out of Catholic school.
I did.
Way to go. Actually, that's not hard to do.
It technically wasn't my fault. It was my older sister. I was given numerous, they call them a judgment under God, in which I once forgot my gym shoes and had to inventory the entire gym under the supervision of a sister, Helen. But it was my older sister who really should take responsibility, because she had what we called the Amy Clause, where every year she would carefully pour through the student handbook and find something that was not explicitly forbidden. So whereas, you know how Catholic school girls always want to make that kilt look a little cuter? Mm-hmm. So they fold it up and then they try to make the pleats fold nicely. Instead of making her skirt shorter and shorter, Amy would make hers longer and longer. So finally she had sweeping navy ball gowns. But it was the year that she and all her friends dressed up as religious figures that I think was the final straw. So I was sent a letter that said I, quote, didn't take the religious nature of the school seriously and was given the boot.
What'd your parents say?
Well, they were horrified, in part because I was obsessed with the religious nature of the school. I was the one Protestant with my sister in a Catholic school, and I was so interested in the religion class that they offered, which probably was a foreshadowing of things to come.
Apparently it was. You then later identified as an evangelical. Right. So tell us about that, what that means, what that meant to you at the time, and why you embraced that.
It's such a terrible term, too, especially here in the States.
Well, here in the States, it's
it means, I mean, baggage. So the historians argue over this endlessly, and they like it's biblicism, crucicentrism, activism, and one other thing I've now forgotten. Mm-hmm. But really, in Canada, it was just kind of a deeply pietistic tradition in which Christianity is something not just assented to, but felt. And so the kind of strongly emotional experience in which you feel a kind of sense of intimacy with God, that's core to the Canadian evangelical experience. What's different, though, is it comes out of an overwhelmingly secular environment. And so you really wouldn't meet your neighbor and say, "What church do you go to?" Mm-hmm. There's just no sense that there's a shared common religious experience. And so because of that, I think you feel entitled to less. And there's certainly no political valence to it. There's not really a Christian political candidate that someone would. No one argues over which candidate would be more Christian. Mm-hmm. So when I moved to the States, I found that it was far more religiously, that religious and political identities were far more conflated. But I'm stubborn and I just stick to it, because if they want me or they don't want me, they're going to have to kick me out.
They're going to have to kick you out, and you're used to that.
That's right.
So
that's right.
I've been kicked out by better churches than you are, you might say. Talk about, you also had a sense, a growing sense of your own feminism that began to emerge around this time. Tell us how that emerged.
Oh, my poor Mennonite Bible camp. I mean, they had the same kind of functional, we would say complementarianism, right? The sense that men and women have their own spheres. Mm-hmm. And they're for the most part, quite conservative. And I had just never heard that men are supposed to do certain things and women are supposed to do others, especially in the context of a Mennonite Bible camp, in which most of it is sing songs and picking up sticks outside if you're on maintenance duty. And so I wanted to be in the truck that drives to the dump to watch the bears eat garbage, which was a privilege only men were afforded. And I thought this was too much. And so I confronted the poor, sweet camp director about his marriage to the camp nurse, and were there spheres in which she was able to operate without his say-so? Could she make medical decisions? I mean, it was If you, to the naked eye, it looked like a 14-year-old confronting a 40-year-old about his marriage to the camp nurse in the cafeteria. And they lovingly tolerated me. But the indignancy that I experienced as a kid just flowered.
Well, did it really flower from that moment? Do you look, obviously now you can look back on that as kind of a moment, but did you start seeing things differently from that moment, or was it sort of years later when you had to fold that into the story?
Yeah, no, I did. Yeah. It was from then on that I was like I permanently took umbrage at things. and I wasn't
particularly
entirely...
nepotism at Mennonite camps. That,
right.
You've never gotten over it.
When will I see those bears? I was just forever affronted. And then I just got more and more helpful vocabulary for it. And my study... Mm-hmm. By the time I got to college, being able to take gender studies as well as religious studies together was a real gift to me. So it's been, it really began there and took root.
Tell us about meeting your husband.
Oh, my poor sweet husband. We met at that same Mennonite Bible camp, and I tried a terrible joke, and it didn't work. And eventually we became friends, but he decided he couldn't date me because I, quote, cried too much and had too many feelings, which sounds a lot like me as a teenager.
If you're a guy, that's a good reason to reject anyone.
So, we just stayed really good friends. And then by the time high school came around, I had eventually wooed him over to my cause. Right. So we've been together since high school.
What was the joke?
Oh, it was terrible. Right. It didn't even make any sense.
Right. Okay. Well, you ended up now, you went to the U.S., you went to college in the U.S.
I did. A nice little hippie school in Minneapolis named McAllister.
Wow, that had to be a transition for you.
It was, I think, because I was ready. Well, partly because I learned everything I knew about American colleges from Saved by the Bell.
I see.
And
I see.
American television. Yeah. I did. I learned about the SATs when Jessie on the show had to take her SATs. And I went to my high school guidance counselor and I said, I think there's a test I need to be taking. So most of my information was from American sitcoms. And I didn't realize that Americans pick colleges based on their personalities. Mm. I picked it based on the glossiness of the brochure. And I was very impressed by it. I was over. Really impressed. And so by the time I got there, I didn't realize that it was full of wonderful left-leaning hippies who hated the small Christian towns in which they grew up. Mm. And having been one of the only Christians in an overwhelmingly secular environment, I was kind of ready to not be the token Christian anymore. So instead, I spent 4 years being in the buffet line where someone in front of me would turn around and say, but how could God be both good and fair? I was like, oh, I just want to get my pancakes. So it was tiring. And eventually, by the time I graduated, I was ready to be done being the only Christian.
What were you, who wasn't fed up with the small town religiosity where they came from? What were your plans, though? Had you sort of focused on religion and religious studies as a career?
Yeah, I was just kind of one track. I wanted to do was, I didn't know I wanted to do American religion yet, but I knew I loved storytelling and the way that we wrap ourselves in these sacred stories. So I took all religious studies, and then I was ready to go to Yale, but I took a year off to go home and get married. And for a year, I worked with special needs kids.
This can always be challenging because if you look at theology as a kind of an academic study, you sort of take it rationally, and then you're also a believer. There's a kind of faith here. You say you love the stories and the way they animate us. Were there any points along the way at this point where it was starting to become a challenge for you? You started to question the roots of a faith that would then, as your friend in line might say, both good and fair.
I think maybe not, only because I was so used to difference. Hmm. Just so many years in an overwhelmingly secular environment in Canada, and then again always being sort of the odd duck, I just kind of got used to it. And then by the time I got through my master's program and to Duke, I was so at home there that it was disconcerting. I was neither to the left nor to the right, and that felt really comfortable.
When did you focus on, or what focused your attention on, the prosperity gospel?
It was my year at home when I moved home from college to get married. And I noticed that, I was driving on the perimeter, which is our one freeway. It's our one crappy road that circles the city.
Is that the one with pavement?
It is one of the only ones in which you are allowed to go fast. Yeah. And then they put up a traffic light, which, of course, I took offense to. But as it turns out, they put up a traffic light because this giant warehouse church had been built that looked what I thought like an American church. And it was our first mega church, which, as it turns out, a lot of my Mennonite friends went to. Mm. And I had heard stories of this celebrity pastor who had started a new liturgical holiday called Pastor's Appreciation Day, and that they had bought him a lovely gift, which was a motorcycle, which he then rode around on stage. And I thought, surely Mennonites, of all people, cannot attend a church like this. And it was in this, it just became a historical puzzle, and I love puzzles. So I started trying to find if there's any secondary sources. No, not really. And so this became the obsession of the Mennonite prosperity megachurch became kind of the beginning of my 35-year-old life's work.
Well, it took you far afield and to many, many places, particularly in the United States. I wonder if you ever solved the riddle of sort of this church in Manitoba. Did anybody ever explain to you why they made the switch? Or if they felt it was a switch? Maybe they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I ended up going back and doing a lot of interviews a couple summers ago. And what I found was it was in part a story about rural Mennonites moving into the city and learning a language of assimilation and accumulation. What was it like for them to feel a little less dowdy, feel a little more modern? And they then wondered, well, so what should I do with all the excess money I have? I mean, these were second, third generation kids, often coming off conservative backgrounds, and wondering what they do with the excess. So they needed a language to describe faithfulness in the midst of more.
So it wasn't, I mean, I'm wondering if there was some kind of rationalization, and I guess the answer is yes, because on the one hand, you could just ignore the fact and pretend that you're not, you know, watching a minister on a motorcycle. But on the other hand, if you say, well, no, but I'm doing good things with my money, I'm giving it to the minister.
That's right. A new language of faithfulness that was appropriate for city life.
Was there a challenge for those Mennonites who might remain faithful to a more simple life? Did it create tension in town?
Yeah, especially when a lot of them would talk about how their parents wouldn't come with them to church and they'd have to go along with a friend. I mean, there was clearly a generational divide in which it wasn't suited to the small town life that their parents were living.
Now, I think before you went back, you also did a work study in a Jesuit chapel. You know about that?
Oh, I love me the Jesuits.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were the wonderful antidote to a Catholic school life in which I loved their endlessly questioning, constantly curious, sometimes totally rebellious faith. And so they let me eat the unconsecrated host, and I set up all the candles and just listened to them wonder. I learned to re-love the Catholics again.
But again, that's a different way of being. Certainly nothing about simplicity with the Jesuits.
No.
By and large.
No. What's fun about them, though, is like this was kind of the beginning of my love of American religion, is that it all has different flavors and they all have different stuff, right? Like the things that they hold dear. So for post-Vatican II middle-aged men, it was the guitar. Like, okay, kids, we're going to sing Wings of an Eagle again.
Because right. With sandals on so we can look like Jesus.
That's right. Are we into this? And then in the same chapel, it's a historically Presbyterian school. On Wednesdays, I was responsible for bringing out the labyrinth. And this was the mainline stuff, right? Apparently, for mainliners, there's nothing that will convert the masses and bring people to the Lord more than 200 pounds of canvas with a labyrinth painted on it. And so I would have to drag it out, ruin my back, fold it out so that no one would come on a Wednesday night for this contemplative practice. But it taught me that, like, everybody has their stuff. Methodists have their weird bell choirs, and Presbyterians have their labyrinths, and Jesuits have their guitars.
When did you then really embark in earnest on Blessed, looking at the prosperity gospel in the United States?
I started the research in my master's program. So I didn't have a lot of money, so I figured I would ruin family vacations and any kind of trip going to the local megachurch. So I visited a lot of megachurches in the Northeast. And then I applied to my PhD program with the intent of doing this project. And then I began to travel around the South, in particular on weekends. Going to anywhere with a Starbucks.
Sometimes in the church.
Oh, absolutely in the church. And not just proudly serving Starbucks, an actual Starbucks.
An actual Starbucks. And I guess there are coupons. You can get coupons.
Like... Yes, that's right. And there's all kinds of coupons you can get depending on. If the church is in a more impoverished area, they might offer coupons for a haircut at a church-subsidized business. I mean, there's all kinds of ways in which these are little cities unto themselves.
So we're talking about this a little bit with a wink, right? I mean, the way, this tone that we're using to talk about a megachurch Could you go into your research with that? I mean, what were you thinking? How could you approach the subject with this much, let's call it, skepticism?
Well, I like the two-parter. I love the sense in Christianity, and especially in American religious history, that there is a deep humor to the stuff we all do, to the guitars, to the labyrinth, to the Starbucks, but also that there is profound sincerity. And that's my favorite part about interviewing, is I go into it assuming that people have real and rich answers to the questions I'm asking, and that they often know better which questions I should be asking. So, I mean, that was my very favorite part of the Prosperity Project, was interviewing lay people, asking them about how they make decisions about the most basic things in their life, how to spend their money, how to understand their health, how to understand their family unity and their togetherness. Prosperity Gospel answers very clearly all of those questions. And so it was a real joy to do.
Well, we're going to take a break now. When we come back, I want to find out what people thought of the discrepancies, the fact that they might be living a very good life and then something awful would happen, or there are some people out there who are clearly not very nice, and they seem to be doing quite well, because I'm sure they've thought deeply about it, and you talk to them, and I want to find out more about that when our conversation with Kate Bowler continues. She's a scholar of the Prosperity Gospel and a professor at Duke Divinity School, the author of Blessed, A History of the American Prosperity Gospel. And we'll find out more in a moment on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Kate Bowler today, recently authored the book Blessed, A History of the American Prosperity Gospel. She's a professor of Christianity at the Duke Divinity School. And so we're talking about your study of megachurches in the United States, the Prosperity Gospel. Maybe we should take one step back and talk about this theory and a little bit of the history of the Prosperity Gospel, where how it got started and why it's taken hold here in the United States so well.
Well, the main roots of it lie in the idea that the mind is a really powerful incubator, that it has the ability through the spoken word to unleash spiritual power. And those are ideas that developed in the late 19th century when Americans were very high on the idea of their own capacity. And so it crystallizes in a movement called New Thought. And then New Thought kind of becomes invisible, just sort of disappears into the culture. And so it becomes a part of almost every self-help book, every You Can Do It bootstraps manual, and then begins to bleed into religious traditions, in this case, especially Pentecostalism. So Pentecostalism offers it a language of healing at first. Pentecostal healers who are traveling the country are trying to figure out why some people get healed and some people don't. And so they start to try to think through spiritual formulas that make it work as they travel from town to town. And so they began to think, a minority began to think, well, what if faith, a certain kind of faith, if spoken out loud, unleashes power that then heals your body? And so so they began to really think about what were the specific conditions under which one person would be healed and one person wouldn't be. So maybe unconfessed sin. I mean, they had a long sort of laundry list of things that you could do to guarantee healing. And then after World War II, when everybody is being lifted by the same economic tides, then they start to add economic money. So maybe it's not just health that God wants for his people, maybe also money too. And so this becomes the kind of foundation of the American Prosperity Gospel.
And you can see some of it if you go back to the Gospels. I mean, Jesus is healing people, and we have to assume that their lives were better, that this was an improvement, or it wouldn't have happened if you were blind and could now see, if you had leprosy and were now healed. These kinds of things were a good thing. God is doing good things. And then the question of whether or not you're living the right life. Mm-hmm. You talk about the word blessed itself, the different ways that it's perceived. It's either a gift, or it can be seen as a gift or a reward when we use this word. And that is some of the, call it confusion, but some of the difference in the way religious denominations would understand these blessings, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, there's a real category confusion in the way that people use the word blessed to say that that they've been given an undeserved gift, or whether maybe they might have something to do with it. And this gets to our, I mean, there's all kinds of questions about the good things that come into our lives and how they happen. So, I mean, Christians have had a historic commitment to healing as an example of something that God might do, but they have been very reluctant to boil it down to this plus this equals. And this is the kind of thinking, though, that our culture has become more and more comfortable with, is what are the conditions under which we can guarantee that good things will happen to us?
So, again, in your interviews, when you point out that you may have prayed a lot and you're doing well, that seems to validate the theory, but there are all of these other counterexamples. How do people manage this? What do they say about them?
Well, I think the hardest version of it is when they turn inwards and they think, well, what have I done? I mean, what is it about who I am that has caused this to happen? And that's one of the most common sermon topics is things you can avoid in order to prevent these tragedies from happening, both economically and physically. But it can be, I think, the hardest part. To me, I am quite sympathetic to the prosperity gospel insofar as when I study it, I see people who have found a language that helps them describe the way that God loves them, like the way that God cares about not just, you know, the hairs on their head and whether they get that promotion and whether their kid is doing well in school. I mean, it gives them a real thick language of blessing. And I've seen that do wonders for people. But the hardest part is in seeing people condemn themselves for tragedies and the follow-up.
And yet, again, this is the Christian tradition, so I'll make reference to the Gospels here. It's pretty clear that one of the key moments in the Gospel is the suffering of the Son of God, according by the Gospel tradition. This is an important lesson, that suffering is a part of both the human and now, according to Christian theology, for the first time in human history, part of the divine experience. Mm-hmm. Suffering is very important. How is that handled in these churches?
Well, they would say that in the death and resurrection of Jesus, that all of that that Jesus breaks, not just the power of sin, but also the power of suffering and poverty. And so Jesus isn't sort of in a shorthand. Jesus does all the bad stuff that we might get all the good stuff, that we might get all the rewards. And so they really turn to the cross as a solution for all problems. Mm-hmm. The problem, of course, is that we have very, just in our day-to-day lives, we have very little evidence that God does always reward the faithful with an easy road.
No, I mean, there's billionaires out there who, you know, we would think, some of us, my goodness, what's the reward there? And there's some very poor people out there who we wonder, how could they have had such a sad life? You went to both black and white mega churches. How did your understanding of race change? Is that at all part of the study? And does it play into this kind of evangelicalism?
Well, and it gets to the way that the prosperity gospel really is so varied in terms of the way it is lived out by race, by class. So I thought the most powerful things I saw was the way that the prosperity gospel gives people a language of human dignity that, I mean, people forget money is not just sort of excess. Money is the very thing that puts clothes on us, that gives us a sense of not just being like the beasts of the field, right? It's easy for the upper middle class to be down on a theology of money when they might then walk into their beautiful stained glass church on Sunday. So one of the kind of long histories of the prosperity gospel is very early on in the 20s and 30s, we have what we might call black prosperity preachers, like a Sweet Daddy Grace and a Father Divine. And what I loved about looking at the pictures, the old pictures, was that for like Sweet Daddy Grace, for example, in his congregation, they might all dress in like beautiful white and be given names like princess and queen. The way that this language of God wants to bless you gives people dignity in the midst of Jim Crow and segregation and a devaluing of black bodies.
And what was your sense of it coming through this and having written it right on that very point, that whatever the theology and however sort of enduring and deep these ideas might be, they do serve an important psychological. They get people over it. So even if it is, you know, as it's dismissed as a crutch, it worked. It's a crutch, and people use crutches because they need a crutch, right? I mean, you need help walking.
Well, in missionary theory, they used to notice that conservative Christians would often produce some of the the conditions of their own success. And they called it the redempt and lift argument. So you become a Christian, you're probably going to drink less. There's sermons against domestic violence. All kinds of things will then create the result that you just pragmatically that you're hoping for. And so I think we see just some of the natural benefits of optimism, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the deep ironies, though, is that as much as I study the prosperity gospel analytically, I am such an obnoxiously de facto prosperity gospel kind of person. I'm naturally sunny, even as I'm about to hit the ground. I'm pretty sure things are about to turn around. And very often I kind of live out some of the sort of de facto habits of prosperity.
Sure.
Preachers.
So there's this practice. There's this kind of doing it, even if by rote you're doing better things than if you didn't take on the practice. But then the downside can be your judgment about other people. If they're not prospering, it might be very easy for you to say, you see, this is God's judgment on them. And we've heard some of that talk from those circles as well.
I mean, some of the saddest interviews I did was like people pushing family members in wheelchairs through a prosperity church while everyone claps them on the back saying that they're just about to get their healing, or they're already healed, they just have to realize it. Or, I mean, I've heard plenty of stories of people being unable to even accept death in the funeral and try to resurrect people, because surely this faithful person, God did not intend for this to happen. So the unwillingness to accept suffering as a part of life, I think, it just really heaps condemnation on tragedy.
And even examples of people who, and I found this surprising, the people who were unable to keep up with their tithes, who were then condemned by the church. Tell us about that.
Well, there are some examples of, so it's very important. So sometimes some churches will have you submit your tax records to make sure that you're giving your 10%. So I've done interviews where people fell behind on their payments because to the church because of health concerns. And then people from the church wouldn't come pray with them in the hospital because they were deemed unfaithful in their tithes.
You, at this point, or during your research, experienced some physical challenge to your arms and feet, right?
It was the most ridiculously dramatic thing. I was just trying to type my dissertation, and all of a sudden my fingers just slowed and stopped. And that began a year of trying to find a diagnosis. And in the midst of that, I'm still doing research. I'm going to healing rallies, sometimes in double arm casts. And you can imagine moths to the flame as people are so concerned about me and want to heal me. And it was quite painful to always have people assume that you're then unfaithful, but also academically incredibly fruitful because you get to hear what people are really thinking and worrying about you. And so there were attempts, you know, to exercise me, attempts to, you know, just give me all kinds of manuals to help me figure out my unconfessed sin. So what is it that I've done that's made this happen?
Do you think you were drawn any deeper? Did you have deeper insights as a result of that particular experience?
I think in a way I wouldn't have before. I mean, church is supposed to be a community, but in a prosperity church, because it's an individual exercise of faith, it can be one of the loneliest places on earth. Because it can be the place that you're perpetually going to with an unanswered prayer in your heart. So I've talked to people who have been asked at the altar to stop coming for prayer because you already did that. And this is just a demonstration of your unfaithfulness.
No.
So as people struggle with illness, children, this sort of like just all the million troubles of parenting, divorce, it can be a place in which your sins feel exposed and you feel incredibly vulnerable.
Yeah, I guess that unwillingness to accept suffering as part of the human condition, and if you are so inclined, the divine plan, since you're human, created by the divinity, would be the hard part. It seems to me, you remember, I think it's Bonhoeffer who said, no, it wasn't Bonhoeffer, it was Martin Luther, who said that sometimes discussing theology is like trying to get a drunk up on a horse. You know, you sort of push on one side and then he flops over on the other side, and then you push him on the other side, and you can't really get there. Because to glamorize, right, or glorify suffering can also be an extreme. The idea that you would then take on suffering as a gift of God and then embrace this as a dramatic kind of proof can be the other side of the prosperity gospel. Am I right about that? I mean, that's the other side of that?
Yeah, I mean, and we can be really facile about who we don't mind suffering, right? It's like we very easily justify the suffering of some and not of others. So it's one of those things in which you have to live in the tension between believing that God desires good things for you and yet not wanting to make a formula in which you work backwards from your biography to God's desires. So what is it about my life that shows that I am faithful or unfaithful can be very dangerous mathematics.
You are having to manage those things now in a way that's not academic. Do you think about how do you manage those? Is it very personal for you? Do you think about your research and some of the things you've said as you sort of work through what you're having to do these days?
I think so. And I mean, I think their lives have been really instrumental in helping me think through what do I expect? What do I think I deserve in this life? Did I really expect that I would live till I was 80 with some kind of academic dynasty of adoring fans? Or did I mean, what did I really think that God owed me? And I think it's hard when, because I think that language becomes not useful in a situation like mine, in which I get 60 days at a time to find out if I get another 60 days at a time.
I mean, the ultimate question in all this that people want to ask is why. The question they want answered is why. And I wonder if you've thought about the importance of that, the value of that question now when you're really in the situation.
I think, at least for me, it's one of the least helpful questions. I think because as a Christian, I think the answer is that the kingdom of God is a little bit here and mostly not. And we see that in the suffering of the world.
You have a husband and a son. They're having to go through this with you. How are they taking all this?
Well, I married a rock, so he's just beautifully, in the best possible way, nonplussed. Last night, for some reason, he still said, you know, I still think I'm getting a really good deal, which is a lovely thing to say about someone who's walking through this with me. But my son is the perfect age for me. He's 2, and so he's just nuts, right? I mean, he tore his own t-shirt off like a tiny Hulk the other day and threw his head back and laughed maniacally and then ran out of the room for no reason. And like, he asks me just with his living to live in the present. And I think that's the most beautiful spiritual practice, is to live in the right now. There's the eschatological horizon. There's the all the things to come. And then there's the right now. And doctors ask you to live in the in-between and all the outcomes and certainties and trials and variables, and I refuse to live there because there's no life there. And so if I live in the present with a tiny little monster and a beautiful husband, I think I'll do all right.
And you are working on a project that will take you into the future. Tell us about women in megachurches and their roles.
Well, I realized quite quickly that I wasn't really done with Mega World, in part because there's just so many things to explore. And one of them is the unexplored role of women and what kind of power they have. Very often they're called first ladies or sometimes just pastor's wives. And they very often run the women's ministry, which can sometimes be these bajillion-dollar enterprises. So some of them have real power. Some of them are decorative in some ways on purpose because they'd rather not do it. And there's a whole variation of the kinds of roles that they embody. And so I've had such a great time doing interviews with women with all kinds of different roles and exploring the role of this sometimes adjunct power that they have, in which their power rests on their marriage and their marriage is a public thing. And so how do they live publicly in these marriages?
Kate Bowler, what a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for spending this time.
It was lovely to be here. Thank you.
Kate Bowler is a professor of the history of Christianity in North America at Duke's Divinity School and the author of Blessed, A History of the American Prosperity Gospel. You can find links to Kate's book and her New York Times piece as well at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Sheldon Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.